Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Crystal and Beek Larson and Andre Redatis. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning,
Paula. Good morning,
Paula.
Gee, you sound so chipper. I love that.
Well,
so
it's a beautiful day here on the Front Range, isn't it? And, you know, we're going to be in the high 70s, maybe even in the low 80s today, and I got out for my run out here by Wonderland Lake and the Foothills Trail up here in North Boulder, and goodness, it's just, we're lucky to be alive and living in beautiful surroundings.
That's so true. You know, it's finally spring. I mean, wherever you are, listeners, if you've had a hard winter, my heart goes out to you. I know that some of the people in the Northeast have just had a terrible winter. And I was in Chicago just a week ago, and the trees still hadn't even started to bloom much, really.
Oh,
they've had a horrible winter on Lake Michigan. And some folks in the North in Michigan are still being invaded by ice that's coming off the lake. I heard that on the news.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, I've never seen that phenomenon quite like that before.
Oh, man. It's just really amazing. So,
yeah,
go ahead, Andre.
No, not at all. Not at all. I was just going to talk about the ice, but we have a show to do.
Yeah, right. Hey, and it's the spring thaw, and spring means new life and resurrection, right? It's the perfect metaphor for what we'll be talking about today. So
Maybe
you can give us just a brief recap on what you guys discussed last week. These guys held down the fort for me. I was at a meeting in Chicago, so I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, we talked about the mansion worlds, and of course the mansion worlds, the Arantia book speaks of as our immediate destiny after this life lived here, you know, when death overtakes us and our physical bodies cease to exist or cease to function, we are still alive. We still have viable souls. And our angels take care of those souls and transport them to a location yet to be disclosed. Well, they've disclosed it and they've revealed it. It's the mansion worlds, but it's about, we surmise it's about 30 to 50 light years from here. It's part of the capital of this local system of inhabited worlds of these 619 worlds that make up the system of Satania. And we join our fellows from those other humanoid worlds, actually human worlds, other human beings that also have the capacity to live and have faith in God and know God and desire to want to be perfect even as He is perfect, and rise up on the mansion worlds. And when we do so, many of us, especially from worlds like ours, which are fairly young and or not very far advanced in terms of where its social and spiritual and philosophical evolution have gone, most of us will arise right on the first mansion world, which is the very, very beginning of the Marantia career, or to put that in other terms for those not familiar with the terms in the Arantia book, the sphere of soul stuff reality is the way I call it, the sphere of combined material woven in with spiritual reality. And they use that analogy directly, talking about it as really an interweaving of matter and spirit, the Marantia reality or soul stuff, where the woof is material and the warp is spiritual. And so that's where we are. And we talked about that first Mansonia, and even before that we talked about the probationary nursery, where those who have not yet made a choice and are generally prior to age 16, children of various ages go and arise in physical form, but no longer differentiated by sex, and are raised by those that need parental experience, and even in part by with feedback from one or both of the parents that have also arisen at the same time. So that's all I'll say about that. I'll let my sister Crystalline chime in. And what have I left out?
That's a very loaded question. Well, we talked a lot
besides
about
that.
Well, we talked a lot about the ideas around children being resurrected, and at what point the personality might begin. We discussed that a little bit. And, boy, you know, the parts that we read, especially with the introduction to that paper, kept us discussing for quite a while.
Well, and so am I correct that from paper 47 of the Arantia book, the Seven Mansion Worlds, you made it to section 4, the Second Mansion World?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, okay. We're just ready to start that.
And I would like to add for any of our listeners who may not be familiar with the Arantia book, it claims to be a revelation from a friendly and well-ordered universe. There's no human author connected with it, which makes it intriguing. And I think that if there was a book that contained this kind of information about the afterlife, about God, Jesus, angels, the history of the world, Adam and Eve, you know, the entire biography of Jesus. I mean, if there and the comprehensive nature of this book, the literary masterpiece that it is, if it's out there and you haven't picked it up and looked at it, I think you should. In fact, I'll go as far as to say, if you knew about a book like this and you didn't tell me, I'd be really upset, because nothing is more comprehensive on the topic of life after death in the Urantia book. I can't even imagine that we would even be able to scratch the surface. And in this one paper is a great example. You could spend a lifetime just studying this one paper. And the three of us have studied these papers in this book for nearly 40 years. So I highly encourage you, if you are experiencing death, if you are facing death, if you are grieving from the loss of a loved one, pick it up, go find it, read it. Nothing, I can't imagine anything could give a person more comfort than these teachings on life after death. And we let Danyon Brinkley kick this series off. Danyon is a best-selling author, and so, you know, he spends his life, because he has died a couple times, three times, I think he said, he spends his life now helping people pass through the portals of death because it's really nothing to fear. And I love, Crystalyn, what you told me years ago when a friend of yours who was suffering from cancer called up and you said, you know, so what's the worst possible thing that could happen from this experience? And she said, well, I could die. And you said, so?
I wasn't quite that insensitive, my dear.
No, I know. I gave her the abbreviated, but tell us, what
I
did you tell
said,
her?
Are you afraid to die? She said, well, no. And I said, well, then, what do you really have to be afraid of? And then she sort of backed off and said, wow, you're right. I've been overreacting to this. You know, and I think that's really one of the most wonderful gifts we have from this revelation, is that we don't really need to be afraid to die anymore. We realize it's just a natural transition process to the next fabulous phase in our life.
And that's faith. You know, it's true, we don't really know for sure. None of us knows for sure what happens because we don't come back. I mean, you know, even somebody like Danyon Brinkley, I mean, a lot of scientists have an explanation for what he experienced. And so there's always room for doubting. But I really refuse to believe that we live this life for naught and everything we gain in this life is for naught.
Well, one of the most wonderful things about the version of life after death that we get in the Urantia book is that it just makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And there's so many things about living life to the end, learning all that we learn, gaining all this experience, this life experience that we gain, often through trial and error and painful realizations. It just really doesn't make sense for us to go through all of that for naught,
right,
for no reason. And when you read in the Urantia book the transition process that we go through after we die, it just makes so much sense. And most people feel when they read it sort of an aha, like,
uh-huh,
oh yeah, that makes sense. That works for me. That really puts all of the pieces together in a way that really, really works for a loving God concept. So many of the other ideas we've had in the past around death and dying just don't really make sense for a loving God.
Right.
Yes.
You know, just one thing to share directly about this, something up close and personal for me, a number of us, we'll be celebrating the passing of a dear friend of ours in the Boulder community named Stan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that will be tomorrow. And, you know, it's a memorial that we're holding much, much later than his actual passing, which was December 27th. And the thing that was related to me about his passing was just how peaceful it was. You know, he had been over 40-year reader of of the Urantia book and a believer in those teachings. And, you know, he died in complete peace, aside from, the bit of pain that he was experiencing as a result of the disease which was taking him. But the real issue there is that these teachings really, really give comfort. And it's not a false comfort. It's the comfort of knowing that in a universe with a loving God, there's only one place to go, and that's up. And you don't have to go if you don't want to. But, you know, with that set of beliefs, most people are going to want to. if you give the universe half a chance and don't allow your own ego and other things to get in the way, which I think very few people do ultimately, but if rather than being a passive adherent to any kind of belief in an afterlife, why not understand this as a huge continuum of which this is just the beginning, and then begin to look at this life as real preparation for a high and divine destiny. That's what he did, and that gave him great, great peace in his passing. He knew where he was going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we can all have. And so that's what we're doing here this morning, is we're reading about that immediate part of our destiny. You know, the vast majority of us are going to land, on the very next steps, the mansion worlds, which were talked about by Jesus and many other teachers that had some revelation of them and revealed them to their followers. So, and now the Urantia revelation gives us that to all be able to know about it. The Revelators obviously believe that for civilization to progress beyond the simple state that it is at today, and to be able to get beyond some of the barbarism which still infects civilization, we really need to know about our full destiny so that we stop living life as though this was the only life to live, clawing and scratching our way to the top, in whatever way. Instead, if we understand ourselves as brothers and sisters because God is our loving creator parent, my goodness, then all of a sudden the whole world changes in viewpoint and in aspect, and we begin to live our lives very, very differently as a result.
You know, what you said reminds me of something our friend Roger Bassett said to me years ago, and it's always stayed with me. He said, even laying down at night and going to sleep, surrendering your consciousness entirely is an act of faith. And death is like that, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
You every night you lay down and you surrender your consciousness completely. Anything could happen in the middle of the night. And, if you're like me, you sleep soundly, you don't wake up like altogether momentarily that you could react to any situation that might happen. I mean, it takes me a little while for my brain to start to function. And so, I could be taken totally off guard if something happened in the middle of the night when I was sound asleep. I would not be cognizant enough to even react to it. But yet, I still, every night, lay down and surrender my consciousness. And I've gone into surgery two or three times, where the last thought I had was, Father, my soul is yours. And keep me. I have faith. All is well. If I wake up in this world or the next, I'm fine with either. I'll do my best to live that new day, whether it's here or in the next world, to the best of my ability. And to do you honor and justice. And, I think that's important to remember, that, you know, every human that ever lives here also dies here. And it's something we all face. And yeah, we want to, you mentioned sin. We want our lives to matter. And Stan was a person who lived a really good life. And he was a very conscious person. And he was very conscious of natural medicine and natural ways of living. Yet he still died. And as we all will, you know, yeah. It's important to live this life well, as yeah. good as you possibly can. But don't try to cheat death. Death will come to all of us. And the good news is, and I think, Crystalyn, that was the point I was trying to make about you and your friend. Death is not the end. It's the beginning. It's a beginning, a new beginning. And, you know, we've talked about it before, about how a baby must feel when its environment is rejecting it. The womb is totally rejecting it and pushing it out into the big cold world. You know, yet there is life. And I see that pattern also in death. It's another birth. It's really not a death. Too bad we even call it that. I wish we could think of another word for it, but the reality of just life renewing itself in a different form, in a different place. So who wants to read The Second Mansion World?
I would be willing to.
Okay.
Excellent.
Cool.
Take it away, sis.
All right. So this is section 4, paper 47. The Second Mansion World. It is on this sphere that you are more fully inducted into the Mansonia life. The groupings of the Marantia life begin to take form. Working groups and social organizations start to function. Communities take on formal proportion, and the advancing mortals inaugurate new social orders and governmental arrangements. I'm going to just interrupt myself to redefine Marantia and Mansonia. For those who are just joining us for the first time today, Mansonia is referring to all of the transitory mansion worlds, that all 7 of the worlds that we go through, or perhaps more, after we die. And Marantia life is referring to the life that is in between physical and spiritual form. All right, I'll continue. Spirit-fused survivors occupy the mansion worlds in common with the adjuster-fused ascending mortals. While the various orders of celestial life differ, they are all friendly and fraternal. In all the worlds of ascension, you will find nothing comparable to human intolerance and the discrimination of inconsiderate caste systems. As you ascend the mansion worlds one by one, they become more crowded with the Marantia activities of advancing survivors. As you go forward, you will recognize more and more of the Gerizim features added to the mansion world. The Sea of Glass makes its appearance on the second Mansonia. A newly developed and suitably adjusted Marantia body is acquired at the time of each advance from one mansion world to another. You go to sleep with the seraphic transport and awake with the new but undeveloped body in the resurrection halls, much as when you first arrived on mansion world number 1, except that the thought adjuster does not leave you during these transit sleeps between the mansion world. Your personality remains intact after you once pass from the evolutionary worlds to the initial mansion world. Your adjuster memory remains fully intact as you ascend the Marantia life. Those mental associations that were purely animalistic and wholly material naturally perish with the physical brain. But everything in your mental life, which was worthwhile and which had survival value, was counterparted by the adjuster and is retained as a part of personal memory all the way through the ascendant career. You will be conscious of all your worthwhile experiences as you advance from one mansion world to another and from one section of the universe to another, even to paradise. Though you have Marantia bodies, you continue through all seven of these worlds to eat, drink, and rest. You partake of the Marantia order of food, a kingdom of living energy unknown on the material world. Both food and water are fully utilized in the Marantia body. There is no residual waste. Pause to consider. Mansonia number one is a very material sphere, presenting the early beginnings of the Marantia regime. You are still a near human and not far removed from the limited viewpoints of mortal life. But each world discloses definite progress. From sphere to sphere, you grow less material, more intellectual, and slightly more spiritual. The spiritual progress is greatest on the last three of these seven progressive worlds. Biological deficiencies were largely made up on the first mansion world. There, defects in planetary experience pertaining to sex life, family association, and parental function were either corrected or were projected for future rectification among the material sun families on Gerizim. Mansonia number two more specifically provides for the removal of all phases of intellectual conflict and for the cure of all varieties of mental disharmony. The effort to master the significance of Marantia Moda, begun on the first mansion world, is here more earnestly continued. The development on Mansonia number two compares with the intellectual status of the post-magisterial sun culture of the ideal evolutionary world.
So there you go. That's the second mansion world.
Yeah.
And we've had... Go ahead.
Oh, do we have somebody on the line?
No. I was just going to say we've had some comments on the board as we were reading that, which were interesting. But go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, it's interesting to see just as the first mansion world takes us to the level of the post-Adamic dispensation, this one leading us to the post-magisterial sun dispensation, the thing that we need to put in mind there, if you study what that dispensation is like, it's really, really quite advanced. I mean, even the post-Adamic dispensation, by the time Adam and Eve are here and civilization goes up, we have a real tremendous scientific development that has occurred. Civilization has progressed. There's a universal language that has generally evolved. Well, right there, we're well behind. But what that prepares us for is for a largely philosophical revelation that really prepares us for an understanding of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, particularly the brotherhood of man and an age of beginning to serve even before a full spiritual age kind of takes off. And this is all before there's ever a bestowal sun on the planet. So the idea here, when they're looking at deficiency ministry, for people coming from this planet, we've got so many things going on. When you look at the state of most of our families, when you look at what people miss in terms of just basic physical necessities through much of the world, and how that deprives family life. When you look at how parents come with really quite wide and varied skills and abilities, and it's a patchwork. Some have skills and abilities in one area, some in another, and generally on this planet it's at a fairly low level. People being raised in those kinds of families can hardly expect to reach their full potential intellectually, let alone spiritually. And so a lot of that gets remediated. For me, the second mansion world essentially is the place of intellectual and philosophical remediation. First, intellectual, just basic mental health, even before intellectual. There are all kinds of psychological disorders that while we won't necessarily arise with those psychological disorders, we will perhaps arise with the lack of development that those psychological disorders prevented us from acquiring. From achieving, thank you. Yeah, and so as a result of that, we're going to go through a lot of intellectual training. I think a lot of people on Urantia, you know, even if they don't have that much to overcome on the first mansion world, most people will have a lot to overcome on the second mansion world.
Yeah, you know, that really came through.
Well, I imagine each of them. Sorry, go ahead, Paula.
No, go, Crystalline.
Just
you imagine what?
It seems really clear to me that on each of these spheres, we're going to have a lot of work to do. I mean, a lot of remediation or making up for deficiencies. We're only just in the last generation in North America have even begun to look at any type of parental remediation or training. You know, I'm just thinking of Love and Logic training program that's out there for new parents, you know, to learn how to parent in a more loving way. And we've only just recognized very recently that there are any ramifications to mistakes made during early childhood development in kids. You know, these are really basic levels of civilization that we have only just begun to consider that maybe we need to focus on.
You know,
pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
And so often, I know you guys have experienced this too, people who have some serious mental disorders don't really know they do. And, you know, there's this thing that we call denial, too, that all of us are in to some degree or another. And I think, you know, it's a classic. I imagine it like a classic epiphany where somebody shows you something that was in your blind side. And all of a sudden you see it. And once you see it, you can't not see it. It becomes, you know, it becomes apparent.
Yeah.
And, you know, I too, Andre, was amazed by the comment about, you know, you're focused more on the intellectual. And I thought also, if there's listeners out there that don't know what a thought adjuster is and the role that the thought adjuster plays, do one of you guys want to give a quick definition of that? Like you could do that quickly, but...
Of the thought adjuster?
Yeah.
Well, the thought adjuster is a fragment of the primal first source and center, the Universal Father. There's a fragment of his divine spirit, which is the highest spiritual reality that exists in the universe, and also because it's part of the Universal Father, and prior to the divergence of spirit and energy is actually prior to spirit and prior to energy. It's the highest reality known in the universe, and God chooses, in order to be close to his lowest personality subjects, his lowest personality sons and daughters, chooses actually to indwell us with that fragment, and literally is closer to us than our own breath as a result of that. And that thought adjuster's main task is to value that we're living in this life and to help us to elevate ourselves by the gradual growth and evolution in ourselves of a soul that spiritually transcribes every character achievement we have desired to make and have put some effort into making. And by doing so, we have something created in us by that thought adjuster that actually can survive this life. The physical doesn't survive it at all, but the soul does. And that soul is a direct, is directly parented by our mortal mind, which mothers it, is literally the womb in which it grows, and that fragment of God, the thought adjuster, which nurtures it. And that thought adjuster is also called the mystery monitor because essentially, in a way we can't understand, that's the mystery, that thought adjuster monitors our life from beginning of our first moral decision and transcribes absolutely every jot and tittle that has any value at all.
Beautiful. I posted something on the board a moment ago from paper 103. The thought adjuster is the cosmic window through which the finite creature may faith glimpse the certainties and divinities of limitless deity, the Universal Father. I thought that was a cool definition from the book, which defines, you know, that it defines thought adjuster throughout the whole book. Thought adjuster is a concept that is throughout the whole book. And it sounds odd when you first hear the term. Go ahead, Kristalyn.
I was just going to say, it really is sort of the first revelation of this text is the more thorough description of that particle of God which resides within our mind. And it really clarifies how this spirit fragment begins to grow our soul within us. And that process is defined in such a way that we really haven't ever had defined for us before.
Absolutely. And it really shows the personal nature of God's love and the his willingness to take you every step of the way, to share this adventure with you, this experiential adventure from the bottom to the top. There's some great quotes in the book about how we begin at the bottom and we ascend all the way. And through these experiences, we learn and grow and become perfect, even as God is perfect. And really, he experiences that whole entire adventure with us every step of the way in a very personal, very real way, directly connected.
One of the other exciting aspects of the revelation of the thought adjuster in this book is the way in which we participate in God's growing experience of experiential development, learning and growing and learning by mistakes, really, learning how to navigate a more and more spiritual reality as we grow Godward. One of the only ways that we can give anything to God is by our commitment to share this experience of growth with Him. And that concept really is, I think, quite profound, because we realize sort of what our purpose is in the universe as a result of that. And understanding from earlier on what is our purpose in life. I mean, so many people struggle with that concept. Why am I here? What am I doing here? What's this all about? And this relationship, a voluntary relationship with the divine, is what it's all about.
Yeah.
In the most simple sense, really.
Well, and it's like, you know, what we realize, and Andre, what you said was so many of them, you know, the struggles on this world, and the Arranger book really explains that better than anything I've ever found, how that came to be, how we came to be such a struggling world. And, you know, I found great relief in the fact that we're not normal, because I would hate to think that that all worlds go through this. You know,
I'm hearing that in the same tones as, like, Wayne's World. We're not normal.
Have mercy on us. We're not normal. But it is comforting to know that this world is just out of step. You know, I mean, it explains things like how can it be that the universe is teeming with life and we don't know it? You know, it explains that. And so much of, you know, like Crystalline said earlier, it fills in the pieces. But and if you had a jigsaw and half of it's missing, you can hardly get the whole picture. Well, you know, here's all the pieces that you were missing. Now the whole picture, with each new piece, becomes more and more clear, more and more obvious. And reading the book is just a total epiphany that way. I mean, it's like, wow, okay, that makes sense.
More and more obvious and more and more reasonable.
And so, you know, when I think about us as, you know, often I like to compare humanity with a garden. And I love the garden because I get all of these metaphors from gardening. But, you know, You have this little seed, and within this seed is all the potential for a beautiful, glorious plant that may give life-sustaining food or beauty or shade or a home for woodland creatures, that's going to improve the environment in numerous ways, in one of hundreds of ways, thousands of ways. And all of that potential is in the seed. And the seed has to germinate. And it breaks the earth, and here's this insignificant, seemingly insignificant little sprout. Yet the true gardener sees the potential that came, sees A, the potential in the seed, and B, the potential in the sprout, and the true gardener waters it and nurtures it just as lovingly, just as tenderly, as when it becomes a full-fledged, amazingly beautiful, functional plant. And that's us. God doesn't see us as, well, look, it's just a sprout. Yuck. You know? It's just a seed.
Right.
God God sees us in that way. And just like a true gardener who will dig about your roots, you know, pull up the weeds, prune off the dead stuff, God sees us that way too. God treats us that way. He's about, and the whole universe is set up to make us fully functional, beautiful, fruitful, to the ultimate of our potential, the potential that lies within our seed.
Mm.
And that's what the mansion worlds are doing. They're that pruning and you know, taking away the weeds. The weeds are like, to me, the mental disorders, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's really clogging up. That fear you have about that, it's like our friend Errol Strider says, fear is what you add to pain to make it hurt worse and last longer. You know?
Oh, love that quote.
Yeah.
Because that is so, it's so edifying. And I was talking recently with my mom about the first time I felt really debilitating fear. And I was pretty old. And it was a shocker. And I was climbing one of the flat irons in Boulder. We've got these magnificent rocks alongside of one of the foothills right outside of town, and it's sort of the mascot of the town. You know, in all the photographs of Boulder, they show these flat iron rocks. And in climbing them many years ago, I felt really protected on the way up and by this big rock in front of me. I wasn't aware of how high I was climbing or how far there was to fall. But when I got to the top, there were these sort of pinnacles. They call them the fingers, that they're rock outcroppings that jut up and stick out. And it wasn't until I reached those where I felt really exposed. And I was incapacitated by fear. And I didn't know what it was that I was feeling. And my boyfriend, who was climbing with me, sort of sat up there and dealt with my emotional outpouring. And I said, I don't know what's happening to me. I don't know what this is. And he said, well, it's probably fear.
Mm.
And realizing that, sort of growing up with this revelation, I had gotten fairly old in my life without ever experiencing that kind of debilitating fear. And that probably is closer to the norm for us, is to grow up without that kind of fear. And you think about all of the things in your life that you don't do, risks you don't take,
because of
things you don't try because
mm-hmm.
of that type of fear. And
how it paralyzes you.
Yeah. That must be one of the things that gets dealt with in the mansion life experience, because so many of us really are debilitated by fear.
Mm.
Yes, debilitated is a very good word. And I can imagine, and you know, even from near-death experiences that I've heard from people like Danyon Brinkley and others who have written numerous books, I mean, the probably the first thing they realize is that the fear is gone, you know, and they feel peace. So it's interesting to me that they'll describe that oftentimes. And really, when you can take fear out of the equation, then what happens is peace. And
yeah.
I can imagine that for us, especially coming from this difficult world, when we get to the other side, there's a lot of peace for us. And just knowing that the universe is well-ordered, that it's logical, that it makes sense, that it's loving, that it's peaceful, that it's friendly, that these fears that we had, fear of hell, fear of God, oh, of all the fears, to me, that one has
fear
to be the worst.
Fear of punishment.
Right. For being imperfect. Like God doesn't know we're imperfect?
Right.
He made us imperfect. He knows we're imperfect.
Yeah.
This is no big surprise to God.
Yeah. He's not making junk and then saying, oh, dang, I made junk. You know, he's making an imperfect seedling that he knows is going to grow into something that its initial form doesn't necessarily reveal what it's going to be, just in the same way that a caterpillar doesn't reveal what a butterfly, the butterfly that's going to come from it. It's only the faith of having seen that happen over and over that begins to let us know that, oh, that's what can grow from this. Oh. So.
Yeah. That's the potential. So having said
that. I think that statement you just made in one of the portions that I recently read is that there is no, none of that experience of, you know, class distinction, you know, that this is going to be a really brotherly and familial experience. That's, I mean, for a lot of people, that's going to be a real adjustment, that living in a place where everybody's nice to you. Whoa, what would that be like?
Yeah.
And you have to learn to be nice to everybody else that.
And nobody's going to force you to be nice or coerce you to be nice, but they're going to show you how to be nice, what it means to be nice, and the power of things like service and love, the real power of niceness, of truth, beauty, and goodness, the real power of value that, you know, when you thought, as Andre said, you had to claw and kick and scratch, you don't have to do that at all. And that really doesn't get you anywhere. And if you want to invoke the greatest powers of the universe, of the universe of universes, here's patience and love and kindness and altruism, loyalty, faith, sincerity.
Yeah.
You know, those are the lessons, and those are the values which they all uphold, the spiritual values that they're all upholding for us. They're not going to try to teach us spiritual values by being anything less than spiritually valuable, you know?
Yeah.
And so much of what we're taught culturally about some of those qualities, it's just so backwards.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think of so much of our modern, well, not just modern, but what's been held on to down through the ages has been the importance of getting even. The importance of revenge, the importance of besting your enemy.
Outwitting, outsmarting, besting.
And those are actually the opposite of what universe values are.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's read about the third mansion world. Do you want to continue reading, Andre? Or?
I'd be glad to. That
okay.
would be wonderful. And
thank
you know, we ought to say that this really amounts to, you know, for those that came to the book like me or even coming now from a background of having believed in reincarnation, and maybe some of you still do, but I did before I found the Urantia book. You know, this was a wonderful revelation to me that instead of arising here, God really gave us the opportunity to rise progressively, that there wasn't this business of, okay, you may end up to be, you know, a frog, you may end up being, you know, a blade of grass, or you may end up being, you know, a human being in terrible circumstances or good ones or whatever in endless profusion. No, the first mansion world is life number two. The second mansion world is life number three. The third mansion world is life number four. You know, they really are discrete lives. We are given the opportunity to have these as real discrete lives that in some are all, of course, a continuum, are all one life, but we get to punctuate, you know, our realization by really living life in true stages, stages that are discreetly recognizable as lives that have their own value. If it was the only life we were living, it would have value in and of itself. But it's not the only life that we'll be living. It leads to other lives.
Yes. Just like
we
five
don't
leads
only go
to six.
Around once.
And six leads to seven, right. You know, I mean, we can't go. And the other part of that lesson is do it well. You can't do it over. You get to move
yeah.
on.
And, right.
And, yeah. It's beautiful to live in that moment to the best of your ability so that you don't carry any regrets, and I'm sure they'll help you get over those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and realize that, as Jesus said, the mistakes that you make in time will be forgotten in eternity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here we go, life number four. The third mansion world. Mansonia III is the headquarters of the mansion world teachers. Though they function on all seven of the mansion spheres, they maintain their group headquarters at the center of the school circles of world number three. There are millions of these instructors on the mansion and higher Urantia worlds. These advanced and glorified cherubim serve as Urantia teachers all the way up from the mansion worlds to the last sphere of local universe ascendant training. They will be among the last to bid you an affectionate adieu when the farewell time draws near, the time when you bid goodbye, at least for a few ages, to the universe of your origin. When you in seraphim for transit to the receiving worlds of the minor sector of the super universe. When sojourning on the first mansion world, you have permission to visit the first of the transition worlds, the headquarters of the finaliters and the system probationary nursery for the nurture of undeveloped evolutionary children. When you arrive on Mansonia number 2, you receive permission periodically to visit transition world number 2, where are located the Urantia supervisor headquarters for all Satania, and the training schools for the various Urantia orders. When you reach mansion world number 3, you are immediately granted a permit to visit the third transition sphere, the headquarters of the angelic orders, and the home of their various system training schools. Visits to Jerusalem from this world are increasingly profitable and are of ever-heightening interest to the advancing mortals. Manzonia III is a world of great personal and social achievement for all who have not made the equivalent of these circles of culture prior to release from the flesh on the mortal nativity world. On this sphere, more positive educational work has begun. The training of the first two mansion worlds is mostly of a deficiency nature, negative, in that it has to do with supplementing the experience of the life in the flesh. On this third mansion world, the survivors really begin their progressive Maharaja culture. The chief purpose of this training is to enhance the understanding of the correlation of Maharaja Moda and mortal logic, the coordination of Maharaja Moda and human philosophy. Surviving mortals now gain practical insight into true metaphysics. This is the real introduction to the intelligent comprehension of cosmic meanings and universe interrelationships. The culture of the third mansion world partakes of the nature of the post-bestowal sun age of a normal inhabited planet.
Which is an age we should be in.
Right.
But we're more than a dispensation behind.
But there's the rub. There's that pesky word again, normal.
Normal.
We're not normal.
We know not what we do.
Right.
Yeah. We've been true. You know, it's funny, but it's true as well. But, you know, I think it's a good point or a good place to point out that the mansion worlds really are designed for people just like us on highly functional, normal worlds that are, say, highly evolved, evolving into stages of light and life. They can bypass a lot of the lessons that we learn up there by those beings living on those on such worlds are learned on the world.
Right.
So I think that's interesting to point out.
You guys have both mentioned about, you know, the fact that we don't come from or we don't live on a normal world here. And
right.
maybe we could just mention just a few of the things that are the reasons why we don't live on a normal world for our listeners who aren't familiar with that part of the book. Without
mm-hmm.
going into a whole lot of detail, I think that might be, since you've brought it up three or four times now.
Yeah, actually, that's a good idea, and there is actually a quote, I believe, that will encapsulate some of that pretty well. It has to do with, let's see here. Well, there's a couple of places where it will go into that, but they talk about the constellation fathers and the constellation government and that kind of thing. They refer to the fact that the present government of the constellation on our constellation doesn't have just three most highs, which is what the normal retinue is, and of course various constellations might have other Virandadex suns helping them. These are in normal English, this corresponds to what in the Bible was referred to as the Most Highs. Well, on our constellation, there are 12, and that may seem like a departure here, but what they do, the reason there are 12 is we have, number one, we have a Lucifer rebellion that occurred here 200,000 years ago in our system of 600, and at that time, 607 worlds, now 619.
Well,
yeah.
I just think you're going into a lot of detail. And
oh, too much detail. Just, okay. So,
yeah, just
so
like
in a nutshell,
in a nutshell,
we are a life experiment world. Okay, life here was actually designed here and planted here because our planet is a good type of planet to enact an experiment, and every tenth world that is life has evolved on is an experiment world. We are one. That was an unusual feature of our world. There was a Lucifer rebellion 200,000 years ago, and our planetary prince rebelled with him. That completely
upset. Which is
a
spiritual government. That's essentially the spiritual government of this world took our planet into the into a cosmic rebellion,
which completely
really
disrupted
us.
Social evolution, yeah. Social
right.
and spiritual evolution on this planet. So, you know, the dystopian views that we see in the movies a lot of that is there because, and possible, frankly, because we had a rebellion here 200,000 years ago. We had a default of our Adam and Eve. They were supposed to hold to a particular plan without going into the details of it. They decided to speed up the plan and to make it occur according to their plan. They didn't do it rebelliously, but they were kind of tricked into doing so.
They sort of accidentally got talked into defaulting, which basically throughout our whole biologic evolution out of whack.
Yeah,
right.
Hence disease and debilitating mental illness and many of the things that we have to deal with could be traced right back to that.
Right. That would have done well, got a long way to speeding our exit from the dystopia of rebellion. And as a result of that, we don't have that, and we are left to our own resources to do that. Now, those are kind of the first one is really a positive, but it's a difficult thing. The life experiment status. The last two that we've mentioned, the Lucifer rebellion and the Adamic default, are decidedly not positive. They're negative. Although Melchizedek points out that out of negative things, usually very positive things result. And one of the positive things that's resulting is that we're getting to evolve a specific kind of faith that doesn't depend on seeing in order to be faithful. So while many people do not evolve a high faith, those that do evolve high faith are doing so literally a blind kind of very trusting faith that really believes that God is there for us whether or not we can see not only God but the results of having faith. Very often the results of having faith are not apparent. Of course, the person who best exemplified that and the fourth reason we're an unusual world is that our Creator Son, Michael of Nebadon, bestowed himself here 2,000 years ago.
And that's a perfect segue for this quote, Andre, that I just called up from paper 76, which is the second garden. And I want to say that the consequences of both the rebellion, put us in isolation, hence we think we're alone. And isolation can
and
be...
And by isolation, you mean...
Quarantine,
sort of
essentially.
Quarantine.
Yeah, we labor with this idea that there's no other living beings in the universe except us. And then the consequences of default were these debilitating genetic problems that we have to deal with, horrible diseases, mental illness, social problems, like antisocial behaviors. So the consequences were very real, and we deal with them every day. We know we could certainly see what they are, and I said I'm comforted by the fact that all worlds don't have to deal with that, because on some level, when somebody goes into a grade school and shoots up a bunch of little kids, it comforts me to know that that doesn't happen on most worlds.
Yeah.
But this quote.
We're just still exceedingly primitive.
Right.
As a result.
This quote from paper 76 about the second garden of Adam and Eve is just so beautiful to me. It says, misfortune has not, however, been the sole lot of Urantia. This planet has also been the most fortunate in the local universe of Nebadon. Urantians should count it all gain if the blunders of their ancestors and the mistakes of their early world rulers so plunged the planet into such a hopeless state of confusion, all the more confounded by evil and sin, that this very background of darkness should so appeal to Michael of Nebadon that he selected this world as the arena wherein to reveal the loving personality of the Father in heaven. It is not that Urantia needed a creator son to set its tangled affairs in order. It is rather that the evil and sin on Urantia afforded the creator son a more striking background against which to reveal the matchless love, mercy, and patience of the Paradise Father.
And that quote right there is really edifying for Christians who are struggling with the concept of atonement and or why God would need to kill his most innocent son in order to appease his own anger, which logically really makes no sense. If God is the creator of this whole universe, and if he is as benevolent and as wise and as all-knowing as he is, then that need for appeasement through blood sacrifice is really quite illogical.
Amen, sister.
Right. Here is another here's another quote, just quickly, about the worlds of our system. It says, but it is true, this is from paper 114, but it is true that you can have at best only a meager idea of an ideal planetary government. Since the early times of the planetary prince, Urantia has suffered from the miscarriage of the divine plan of world growth and racial development. The loyal inhabited worlds of Satania are not governed as is Urantia. Nevertheless, compared with the other isolated worlds, your planetary governments have not been so inferior. Only one or two.
Compared to other retarded planets, you're fairly similar.
I don't know why that strikes me as funny this time, but it does. Only one or two worlds may be said to be worse, and a few may be slightly better. But the majority are on a plane of equality with you. So, you know, they're kind of telling us, don't feel so bad. You're not so abnormal.
Right.
You're not the absolute worst planet in the universe.
Right.
Well, and scoring.
There are one or two that are right up there with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Well, and underscoring Crystalline's point, it's just a fact that because when you are taught not to question, you know, the belief system you grow up with, the fact is most people are obedient to that or have been in prior ages, and they don't question it, and so they literally don't reflect on the idea. Some ideas are just sort of ingested at a young age and never questioned. But the marvelous thing about the Urantia book is it puts in words in various ways just how one ought to think about it and how the higher celestial beings do think about it and how it can't possibly be the way we're thinking about it. And so in paper 4, in section 5, in paragraph 4, there's this wonderful quote here that underscores what Crystalline was saying, and that is, the barbarous idea of appeasing an angry God, of propitiating an offended Lord, of winning the favor of deity through sacrifices and penance, and even by the shedding of blood, represents a religion wholly puerile and primitive, a philosophy unworthy of an enlightened age of science and truth. Such beliefs are utterly repulsive to the celestial beings and the divine rulers who serve and reign in the universes. It is an affront to God to believe, hold, or teach that innocent blood must be shed in order to win his favor and to divert the fictitious divine wrath.
We're moving
into a cultural phase now where those kinds of ideas are not palatable. They're no longer acceptable in any kind of political correctness.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, we are watching hundreds of thousands of people reject religion in its totality.
Right.
Because it just cannot jive with the value system that we are beginning to learn.
We're
evolving past that. And so the timing is perfect right now for this illuminating revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking, even watching somebody like Bill Maher, who openly really makes fun of religion. He ridicules it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard not to find humor in the way he ridicules religion, because most of what he's saying is right on.
Well, with regard to those pure aspects of religion, he is right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And he's a thinker.
he's thinking.
Yeah.
And I think this is true for a lot of scientists who have a really hard time.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, there's a throwing out the baby with the bathwater, you know, and many of us who found the Urantia book have not done that. We haven't thrown the baby out with the bathwater. And also, many of the wonderful people we've had the great good fortune and privilege to interview on this show that are part of the emergent Christian movement and the emergent movement in general, do not throw the baby out with the bathwater. They throw out the bathwater. They don't pay attention to that, but they pay attention to the baby, which is the fact that there is reality to spirit life, there is reality to God, and a religious and inner life is a life of value and one to be led, and does not conflict. The highest religious life does not conflict in the least with science. It really acts as something which can form the basis of a high philosophy and art of living if you look at true science and look at what science, the best of scientific discovery is finding and what is really verifiable, and match that up with what you have in your inner life, the Urantia book helps you and can actually help you to carve out a wonderful art of living that composes the two and bolsters the view, not only the view, but bolsters your experience that says, yes, you know, of course there's a God. Of course there's a higher reality which is responsible for all the, you know, ingeniously designed life and non-life aspect of the reality that you live even in the physical realm, not to mention what you experience in your inner life.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, you know,
don't get me wrong, I wasn't trying to promote.
I know that.
It's good to point the good parts. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to, what you said, Andre, reminded me of one of my favorite Police songs called Invisible Sun. Just the refrain is, there has to be an invisible sun. It gives its heat to everyone. There has to be an invisible sun that gives us hope when the whole day's done. We have a caller. Shall we take a caller?
Sure.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Okay. We haven't done any station identification, so it's good that they called anyway.
Yeah, right. You're with us on Blog Talk Radio, and we're going to take a caller right now. Hello, caller.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I'm here.
What's your name?
How are you today? My name
Fine.
Is Kelly.
Hi, Kelly. Welcome
Hi.
To the show.
Thanks so much. I'm a first-time listener. And,
oh, wonderful.
I guess, I've just been, I'm 41 and just kind of always been afraid of death and dying. And just this past year, my mom passed away. And I just need some comfort, I guess, and hope.
Well, wonderful.
Well,
So glad you called in.
My search for the truth of the afterlife happened when my dad died, when I was 20 years old. And that experience just throttled me. I don't know how else to describe it. It was quite stunning. And and I started to pray, and it led me to the Urantia book, which gives a very detailed description of life after death, and which is what we're discussing, obviously, on the show. And the more I read it, the more comfort I got. And it just assured me that death is not the end, but the beginning. And that even though my dad is gone and I can't see him again, and that was, 39 years ago, that my dad still is, and that I will see him again. And since then, I've lost many loved ones. I've lost my brother, my mother, my husband, dear friends, close friends, a brother-in-law. And I just know that I'll see them again, that this life is but the wink of an eye.
Definitely.
And then we're together again.
Also, just a little technical note, caller. It would be great if you can turn the sound down on your computer while you're on the air, because we're getting a lot of reverb.
An echo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's an echo.
Huh. That's weird. I don't even really have it on. So.
Don't you?
Oh, really?
Okay.
Oh, well, then we just have a little reverb happening through the line.
It may be
well,
through your phone. It could be a number
too.
Of things.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing that Paula underscores in what you were saying, you know, and all of us, you know, that have experienced the death of a loved one, it doesn't change the fact that we miss them in this life. You know, that
mm-hmm.
loss is real. That not having them in our lives, you know, for...
Not being able to pick up the phone and call.
Right.
Right, definitely.
Yeah. Just having that is a real aspect of loss. But that loss, with the wonderful thing about life and understanding it as a continuum, that death is not the end of life, but just really the beginning of a higher life, is that these losses are temporary. They're only to be experienced in this life, and they actually do have some purpose, because every time we experience this kind of a loss, we have to reevaluate our own lives. We have to go deeply within to say, is there a value to life anyway, even when that which had such great value to me is gone? And when we understand that we're divinely loved by a divine loving parent, part of the losing of parents, and I've lost one of mine, And for me, I definitely relate to that. When my dad died in 2006, it was almost like a vacuum appeared in life, and I didn't I was living 2,000 miles away from my dad, but he was a wonderful guy and a man who just continued to grow in character despite living with profound mental illness. So there's no accounting for what is going to be part of the loss, even when we experience loss while they're alive. The fact is, when he left, the world just didn't feel the same for me anymore. And it still, to some extent, doesn't feel the same. But
I definitely feel the same way.
But what I do understand is that there's still a value to my life and the world, even in this very, very changed and transformed kind of different life that I'm leading now. It's not the life that I had before. It never will be that life again. But what I've lost in this life is not a loss forever. It is something temporary, and it's designed in a certain sense. The way life is designed is to give us these lessons so that we can develop parts of ourselves that may not have developed in any other way, except for experiencing some of these losses.
Yes, I agree.
You definitely do.
How old are you, caller, if you don't mind my asking? And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Oh, my name's Kelly. That's okay. I understand.
Joy?
I'm Kelly.
Oh, Kelly. Okay.
Yeah, I'm 41.
And do you have children of your own?
Yes, I do.
So you have a real sense about those primary relationships and how valuable they are. And,
definitely.
Is this the first loss you've from death that you've suffered?
No. I mean, I've been, I've had my grandma pass and my grandpa and just and things like that. But it's just really, just like you said, it's just really everything is totally changed and
feel disconnected. So, you know what I noticed when my mother died is that I felt keenly disconnected from the past, because your parents kind of connect you to your ancestors, and they remember the family stories and grandma and grandpa and so your ancestors kind of connect you with the past, and but I find an interesting thought is to imagine that they give what they are going to give to this life, and then they move on, and then you benefit from what they gave, and then you move on, and then your children benefit from what you gave and from what they gave all the way back, and then they move on. And so part of your infinite past is also a part of your infinite future, because at some point you'll meet all of them again, even those ones you didn't ever meet, like your great-great-great-great-great, whatever.
Yeah, I know. That's so amazing. If you think about it, it just goes on and on.
Yeah, it's a continuum in both directions, and it does. Mm-hmm. It goes on and on, and the value that they created is never lost. Not on this world and not in the next. The value is valuable. And in one place, the Urantia book says, nothing of value is ever lost. So much, much less human value, relationship value, which relationships are eternal. Those are our treasures in heaven. Jesus said, lay up your treasures in heaven, for where your treasures are, they're also where your heart be. Those relationships are our treasures because they're eternal. And that's the value that we create. When we put more value on things than we do on people, that's when we're betraying our values or those treasures. We're laying up the wrong treasures because things don't last, but people.
No, you can't take them with you.
That's right. But those relationships.
Well, and if you notice too, with things, if you might, you know, really crave some things, you know, something you really think that something will make you happy, and then you get that thing, and as soon as
you're still not happy.
Well, and as soon as you get it, it's not the thing that you're really yearning for anymore.
Right.
It, you know, it sort of loses its. A lot of it's mystique as soon as you have it. Whereas spiritual values, the more you have, the more you get and the more you want and the more you benefit from that.
Mm.
It's like it's really a noticeably ongoing benefit from the spiritual values.
Definitely.
One thing I know about the grieving process, too, is that when I was grieving the loss of my dad, it took me a full 2 years to get to where I could think of him and not cry. And I knew that I had gotten through the process when I thought of him and laughed. I noticed I was quite a distinct difference when I could think of my dad and my heart would fill with joy, not sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the memory of that precious person in my life. And that's huge. But it is a process you got to go through. Grieving is a process. And like Andre said, you know, a loss is a loss.
Right.
You have to go through it, but there's value even in that process. And I think from losing my dad, I learned to express to people every day in some way or another how much I value them. Because I had
Definitely.
A lot of regret. I was only 20 when my dad died, and I had a lot of regret that I didn't tell him how much he meant to me.
Aww.
And I spent a lot of time wishing I had him for just 20 more minutes so that I could tell him. But then I realized, you still can tell him that. And or her.
I have to say, I still get choked up sometimes, even just listening to you talk. I've got tears just pouring down my face. And I realize there are some aspects of the grieving process that continue on for the rest of your life when you have certain things that trigger them.
Yeah, which sometimes is everything. You know, you can look at food or you can look at, you know, anything and you're reminded, oh, you know, my mom would think this is so neat or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
or I really wish she was here.
Yeah.
We're all gathered for Thanksgiving, and then Mom isn't here.
Right, there's there's something missing.
Yeah.
And then I find, too, when I hear other people share their experiences that are similar in some way to what I just went through, it'll trigger it for me again. And it's just that is one of the things that makes us vulnerable with each other and makes us human, that the sharing of the grief. You know, Jesus said, you know, happy are they who mourn when a friend is at hand to comfort.
Right.
And, you know, you wonder, why would he say happy are those who mourn? How can mourning be happy? You know,
right.
it doesn't really make sense until you share that experience with somebody else who's going through the same thing. And you realize that there is a certain sense of connection that we get when we share those losses together. Because it's really a part of the human experience that no one gets to avoid. Every one of us has to experience that at some point.
Yeah.
And part of the fact that this is a difficult world, it makes it a little harder because you hate to lose your biggest fan. I mean, it wouldn't be easy under any circumstances. You know, Kelly, I grabbed a quote from the Arantia book for you that I think might be meaningful. You know, the Urantia book talks about life on highly evolved worlds where humans don't have to go through natural death. They actually go through this thing called fusion where they fuse with the spirit within them and then they translate to the other world. It's like a fast track. They get to go right there. They don't have to go through debilitating disease and death. They still have to leave. Nobody gets to stay here forever, obviously, and I don't think we'd want to. If we knew all of the wonderful things that
right.
the universe has in mind for us, we wouldn't want to stay here forever. We want to move on and explore all of the beauty and glory and all of the lives to come. But these particular people go through a process called fusion on a highly evolved world. And this is from a paper called The Spheres of Light and Life. That's the level of high evolution. And it says about these candidates, these fusion candidates, many fusion candidates may be assembled in the spacious temple at the same time. And what a beautiful occasion when mortals thus foregathered to witness the ascension of their loved ones in spiritual flames. And what a contrast to those earlier ages when mortals must commit their dead to the embrace of the terrestrial elements. The scenes of weeping and wailing, characteristic of earlier epochs of human evolution, are now replaced by ecstatic joy and the sublimest enthusiasm as these God-knowing mortals bid their loved ones a transient farewell as they are removed from their material associations by the spiritual fires of consuming grandeur and ascending glory. On worlds settled in light and life, funerals are occasions of supreme joy, profound satisfaction, and inexpressible hope.
Oh, wow. That's very nice.
So someday, your children's children, perhaps, won't have to have that pang of grief, or know that
of loss.
And loss. They'll be able to celebrate that ascension, that graduation, for what it is. Just as this book says, with supreme joy, profound satisfaction, and inexpressible hope.
Yeah.
And we can hold that now. You know, we can hold that in our hearts even now, knowing that our loved ones are in such good hands.
Yeah, I believe that too.
Yeah.
But one of the real gifts to the portion of the book that we're reading today is that we have more than just a belief that this is what's going to happen and this is where we are in the universe. We now have a really vivid description of what's going to happen in the next couple of transition spheres. And there's something romantic about that. It's not just eliminating our fear or calming us down sort of thing. It's actually really kind of exciting to think about. And that's a new way of approaching death for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not saying that you're going to get there right away because you've still got grieving to go through. But while you're grieving, for you to imagine this amazing experience that your mom is going through, you know, really helps. It really helps to know that she's having this amazingly romantic adventure.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It is. You know, I met somebody in New York City because I was exhibiting the Urantia book there at an expo, and she came up to me and expressed that she had lost her only son, her only child, and how terrible that grief was. And she said that she was so distraught and so just completely overtaken with this grief, that her friend became very concerned about her. And her friend said, you know, I've had a near-death experience, and if you will come over to my house, I'd love to tell you about it. So the lady that was grieving agreed to go and meet with her friend. And her friend, who had a certified death, in other words, I think she was dead for 8 minutes, and then they brought her back.
Oh, wow.
She told her friend that when she was on the other side, she was accompanied by an angel, and she saw off in the distance a rainbow. And people, other beings, they're stepping into the rainbow. And she asked the angel, what is that rainbow? And the angel told her, if you step in that rainbow, you can hear all the loving sentiments and all the words of you know, and prayers and hopes from all of your friends on earth who didn't get a chance to tell you what they wanted to tell you while you were still there. And she said, you'll be able to hear... Yeah, you'll be able to hear the prayers of the people there and their well wishes for you on your way, on your new journey. And she brought that back with her, and she told it to this woman who was grieving. And she told the woman, now, tonight when you go home, pray to be in the rain. Pray that your son will step into the rainbow and hear what you have to say, because her grief was largely because she never got to say goodbye to him, and she didn't get to say all the things that were in her heart to say. You know, it was that regret, like I was saying earlier. And so that night when she went home, she told me this whole story while we were standing there at this booth. She said, I went home, and I got down on my knees, and I prayed that God would let me go into the rainbow, actually allow me to say what I wanted to say, and that my son would hear it. And I think that's the important part. And so she prayed very hard, and she imagined that she went into the rainbow and she told her son all of the things she wanted him to hear, especially goodbye, how much she loves him, and that she's sorry, you know, that she didn't get to see him one more time before he died. And then she cried and went to sleep. And she said then she had a dream, and in the dream she was standing on a street in New York City. And her son pulled up in a car, pulled up to the curb, and he rolled down the passenger side window. And she leaned in, and he said to her, Ma, I heard your prayer, Ma. And I want you to know that I'm fine, that it's wonderful here, and you don't need to worry about me, and that we'll see each other again. And he said, and I'm sorry I didn't get to say goodbye to you too, Ma, but it's okay. And he took her hand and he kissed it. And she said, and then he said, I've got to go now. And she stood up again, took her head out of the window, and he rolled up the window and drove off.
Oh,
and,
wow, how pretty.
Yeah,
that probably was such a comfort to her.
Oh, amazing. And she told me she looked at me at that point in the story with a sparkle in her eye. And she said, so that's how I know there is life after death.
Definitely.
And I think that it's important to, through universe ministry, I really believe this, that if you want to say something to your loved ones on the other side, that message gets to them. I really do believe
that. Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. There's a connection
there. Thank
you
so much for sharing all that with me.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for calling and sharing your experience with us.
Well, thank you. You've really helped me today, so thank you to all of you.
You bet.
Oh,
thank
you're
you
very
for calling
welcome.
Yeah, nice to make your acquaintance, Kelly.
Thanks so much.
You
I
know,
will definitely.
We're going to be doing this series for the next couple of weeks, so feel free to tune in with us on Saturday mornings at this same time, and
okay,
feel free to
great.
Call in again.
Okay.
And
well, thank
you know,
you
you're
so
welcome
much.
To stay on the line. We're not trying to kick you off now.
Oh, I know. I understand.
Okay.
All right.
So.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Have a nice weekend.
You
thank
too.
You.
God bless you, Kelly.
Bye bye. God
bye-bye.
Bless you as well. Thank you. Bye bye.
So, Crystal in the fourth mansion world.
Okay. And Kelly, if you're still listening, here's even some more romantic information about life after death. We're on paper 47 of the Arantia book, section 6, the fourth mansion world. When you arrive on the fourth mansion world, you have well entered upon the Arantia career. You have progressed a long way from the initial material existence. Now are you given permission to make visits to transition world number 4, there to become familiar with the headquarters and training schools of the super angels, including the brilliant evening star. Through the good offices of these super angels of the fourth transition world, the Arantia visitors are enabled to draw very close to the various orders of the sons of God during the periodic visits to Gerizim. For new sectors of the system capital are gradually opening up to the advancing mortals as they make these repeated visits to the headquarters world. New grandeurs are progressively unfolding to the expanding minds of these ascenders. On the fourth Mansonia, the individual ascender more fittingly finds his place in the group working and class functions of the Arantia life. Ascenders here develop increased appreciation of the broadcast and other phases of local universe culture and progress. It is during the period of training on world number 4 that the ascending mortals are really first introduced to the demands and delights of the true social life of Arantia creatures. And it is indeed a new experience for evolutionary creatures to participate in social activities which are predicated neither on personal aggrandizement nor on self-seeking conquest. A new social order is being introduced, one based on the understanding sympathy of mutual appreciation, the unselfish love of mutual service, and the overmastering motivation of the realization of a common and supreme destiny, the paradise goal of worshipful and divine perfection. Ascenders are all becoming self-conscious of God-knowing, God-revealing, God-seeking, and God-finding. The intellectual and social culture of this fourth mansion world is comparable to the mental and social life of the post-teacher-son age on the planets of normal evolution. The spiritual status is much in advance of such a mortal dispensation. I wanted to also just mention to Kelly, if she's still listening, that the Arantia book is available for you to read for free online. And it's also available in many bookstores. And Paula, maybe you can just touch in on that a little bit.
What, to be able to find the Arantia book?
Yeah.
It's available on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble. It's available in many formats, including Kindle. The entire audio book is available to download for free. And you can listen anytime online, or you can download it and put it on your iPod and listen to it. And that's available at www.urantiabook.org. It's also available at other sites as well. The book is available in PDF format freely to download. We have programs where if you can't afford it, we'll send it to you. You just need to contact us. Again, you could click contact us at the site, urantiabook.org, and search Urantia. Search it on Google. You'll find it. It's pretty prolific on the web.
And you spell Urantia, Urantia.
Yeah.
All right. So any discussion on what I just read?
Well, I want to point out that there's an interesting correlation between this and the Planetary Mortal Epics paper. Because the Planetary Mortal Epics paper really covers what would happen on a normal planet. And so it's kind of interesting. It's a very interesting correlation, I think, because they've alluded now that, you know, this makes up for a deficit that we might have gotten on this world had we had, you know, been normal. And there's that word again. And so the planetary epics, the planetary mortal epics paper really talks about the normal planetary evolution and the evolution of culture and civilization. And so it's an interesting correlation. And that's paper 52 of the Urantia book. So I just find there's an, and then there's also an interesting correlation too between the normal epics of evolution and the seven psychic circles, I find. So you kind of can gauge where we are. I think the book says we're more than a dispensation behind. So we're not really at that post-bestowal sun age.
The other thing I find interesting about the different planetary mortal epics is that on our world, we're kind of in several at the same time, depending on where you are in the world. There are some parts of our world that are still, you know, practically in the Stone Age.
Yes.
There are some other parts that have evolved through the agrarian state, and some that are only just now starting to reach the industrialized phase of evolution. So it's that I find those papers to be really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is an interesting comment, too, from what you just read, Chrislyn, where it says, it is during the period of training on world number 4 that the ascending mortals are really first introduced to the demands and delights of a true social life, a Urantia creature.
Isn't that wonderful?
I wonder what a true social life. I mean, Andre, you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, what strikes me immediately is there's a give and take that that is occurring that just describes the lowest level of that, where people would be genuinely interested in receiving, you know, your contribution, hearing what you have to say, receiving what it is you have to contribute as an action, you know, in some social realm, and willing to have you do the same in kind, not thinking that there's something superior to what they're providing that you can't provide, and vice versa. There's really a sense of equity and equality that is evolving in the mindset of that age, and a real comprehension that every person has something of value to offer.
Mm-hmm.
That we're so far from that on this planet. There's so much deference to those that have extraordinary talent, extraordinary wealth, you name it, extraordinary beauty. All of those things tend to captivate us here in this life. Not every last person, but so many people that the exceptions really stand out when somebody is already at this stage of honoring people as equals, no matter who they are. That's born of a real understanding of the truth of the spiritual equality of all persons and the true value of all personality. Personality, as far as I can see in the Urantia book, is the highest humanly experienceable reality, and it is best knowable by the highest exponent of will function, which is to love others. And we're given that beautiful and succinct definition of love, which is the desire to do good to others. And when we're practicing that, we're really engaging in true personal intercourse. We're really, you know, engaging and getting to know and really truly loving our fellow human beings as brothers and sisters.
Good point.
Well, and I'm moved also by the fact that every interaction isn't dominated by self-aggrandizement and conquest. That's really fascinating. It really illuminates how much of our experience of socialization here is about the other.
It goes back to
you
what
know,
you
it's
were saying
based
before.
On competition and one-upping each other and being better than someone else. I mean, that runs through so much of our culture.
And really, the life of Jesus was a life of service. If anybody could have one-upped us all, made us all feel pretty schmaltzy and small and worthless, it would have been him. But he never did that. He came here to lift us up, to show us our own value, to love us, to serve us, as is illustrated by his, you know, his foot washing episode. When once again his apostles were doing just what you described, Crystalline, and that is trying to one up each other, vying for a seat at the table, you know,
right?
Because they were the
wanting to be
one.
In the honored seat,
right? The preferred seat. Yeah. Well, I think that's such a good point, and you've really made that point today, and I love it. Is that, you know, we spend far too much time and doing that, and really in the end, that's about us not feeling good about who we are. You know what I mean? When
and
we try to make we try to who are we trying to convince really that we're the great? You know, who are we
even our recreation,
to?
Even the things we do for fun.
Competition.
You know, are frequently about competition. I don't know if you've ever been through a ropes course. That was an experience that I had years ago that was really moving to me, because it was about cooperation. There were certain things you couldn't master in that process unless you really cooperated with each other. And
right.
It was around team building and creating a sense of not codependency, but mutual dependency. It was really a great experience, and I remember thinking, wow, this is important to know.
Yeah, it's important to know. And, you know, here's another example of where we get into a very unhealthy one-upsmanship is with religion and this idea, the very thing we're talking about today, and that's eternal life, that God is going to give it only to some of us. And only to those ones who say it just this way or believe it just so, that only they get, because it's the ultimate competition then, you know. God likes
right.
me best.
Yeah,
hey,
you know,
rivalry.
It better be a lot more than 144,000 arising in the next life, because, you know, I mean, if God's that small, that's all the room he's got, well... I'll defer to them. They can have it. But somehow I have a feeling that there's a lot more room that an infinite God has created in his universe for all of us. And what's wonderful about these mansion worlds is we get to see, you know, we're not overwhelmed at first. You know, the next lives are not that much different in many respects, at least in the personal interaction aspects. As this life, except that
right.
it keeps getting better and better. We start to value those personal interactions more and more. We get better at it, and so do a lot of others. And so we get to experience life on a very different plane. speaking of plane, we're about
it's time to land
to,
the plane.
Yeah. We got about a minute.
We're down to our last minute. but we'll be back.
Yeah. Yeah. And next week it'll be the fifth mansion world where we'll start
right.
out. So thank you, you two. It's wonderful to be on the show with you. Wonderful to share insights. And thank you to all our listeners out there for tuning in. It really, really. And to Kelly for calling
yeah.
in. Absolutely.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Kelly.
Yeah, so join us again next week, same time, at Blog Talk Radio, The Cosmic Citizen. Until then, bye for now.
Bye for now,
everyone.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.